Turn your tax refund into a new landscape with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Create stunning patios and build strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of beautiful concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, easily build and design your own raised garden beds with our garden block. On sale now. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Turn your tax refund into a new kitchen with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Renovate your space with new cabinets from Cardell. They're ready to install and come in a variety of styles and finishes with free shipping to your home. Visit our kitchen showrooms in store. Or go to Menards.com for free estimates today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of our hot deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to Breaking Math, the podcast where numbers are imaginary and we have the opportunity to explore another planet, Mars to be exact. I'm your host, Autumn FNAF, and today we're diving into part two of A City on Mars, where we're getting into the nitty-gritty of building a Martian society. In this episode, we're here to talk about everything from the biology to space politics with the author Zach Wiener-Smith, the mind behind the wildly popular webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, where science meets punchlines. If you like our content, consider supporting us at Breaking Math for future episodes. You can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/breakingmath for a dollar. You end up getting the episodes ad-free. We're also looking for hot new topics and potential new guests on the show. If you're interested in connecting with us or giving us an intro to someone that you know and think would be a really awesome person on the show, feel free to fill out the form below in the description or email us at breakingmathpodcast@gmail.com. Now, let's take a moment to listen to our sponsors.
So if we're thinking about this and we're looking at the whole ecosystem there, think what is like the repercussions of us from planting all the way to actually building a population?
If you assume, say it this way, like say the starship is working, the rockets are flying, mass to space is a, if not a solved problem, a much easier problem. What's left? We argue there's essentially two big hurdles, which are reproduction and ecosystem design. So let's talk about human reproduction. I'll keep it PG-13. So the first thing to know about space is it reliably, rapidly produces all sorts of physiological problems for people in space. It degrades bone density in your hips at a rate of something like 1% per month. Let me emphasize per month, right? So you might say, per month, why do astronauts not end up like that Harry Potter spell where your bones disappear? Well, there might be some upper limit, but we haven't found it yet. So like I said, the longest trip to space ever was Polyakov in 93 to 94. He was up for 437 days. Down from that, I think it's about a year. And I think something like six people have been up for more than 300 days. And so we don't have really good longitudinal data. I think the largest total for an individual is on the order of like a little under 900 days. So we really don't know a lot. We're missing a lot, but we do know it's really bad for your bones, very bad for muscles. It's considered very impressive if after a few months in space, you can come home and walk.
Didn't they also do a twin experiment that parallels that?
The Kelly brothers. Yeah. So, you know, Mark and Scott Kelly, one is a senator, one is an astronaut. They're a very impressive family. I'm sorry, no, the astronaut is also a senator. Let me not, I don't want to get this mixed up. Kellys. So you have a twin study, which is nice for space. And so one is up for a year and one's just down on Earth, which is, you know, for real science, you'd rather have more controls than one-to-one, but they're twins. That's pretty cool.
Right.
What's a little scary about that is my understanding from that study is there were even equivocal concerns about, meaning the data is equivocal, it's hard to know for sure, but about cognitive effects. So meaning like there might be some sort of cognitive decline having to do with space. People have talked about having a kind of brain fog. from doing space. The problem is we don't know. It's obviously quite stressful to be in space, both physiologically and just sort of in the usual sense of stress. But also, yeah, I mean, all sorts of weird stuff is happening in your body. You get bacterial loads that are different from the ones you get on Earth. Reliably, there is damage to vision, which could actually just be an indicator of other nerve damage. We don't know. You're also getting hit by more and different types of radiation than you tend to get on Earth. So you're also not, you know, you're breathing an atmosphere that's actually quite different. So people think if you go to space, you're breathing an atmosphere that's kind of like Earth. It's actually like on Earth, we don't breathe a lot of carbon dioxide. It's a couple hundred parts per million. In space, it's about 1%. And people complain about headaches from that because it's just hard to scrub all that carbon. There may also be micro effects. So one thing we do with space equipment is we check it for outgassing, right? So when you buy... we get a package from Amazon and you open it. Maybe there's a little kind of weird plasticky chemically smell, but who cares? Because it's it goes out into the atmosphere and whatever. In space, that stuff gets, you know, you're in a sealed system. So they have to check equipment for outgassing, even if it's at trivial levels. Right. So NASA keeps a document called, it's called SMACS, and I will never remember. I think A is for atmosphere, but I can't remember what the SM and C are for. I'm bad with these things. But yeah, so essentially they say it's like, you know, the longer you're in space, the more we require there to be Earth-like levels of all sorts of chemicals. And so, you know, I'm teeing this up for reproduction because my point is we really don't know what this does, but everyone who's been to space, almost everyone who's been to space has been a mature adult, so they have a mature adult body. By the way, just as a by the by, only about something like 1 in 7 of those have been women. So we're even really lacking data on women in the long term. And so,
isn't that historically accurate for everything, though?
Oh yes, no, I you know, it's one of these things too, where it's just like, you know, it's like sexism is like it keeps biting you because, like, well, NASA is now the astronaut classes are now highly integrated. It's about 50-50 boys and girls, but you know, the first class that allowed women was 1978. It was not that long ago. You know, it was after Star Wars, right? So like really recent, and that was 6 out of 35, and none of them were, you know, the first pilot was Eileen Collins, I think, in would have been 94, I think. None of the caveats apply that we don't have a lot of longitudinal or variety of bodies type of data. For women, it's like times 10. And so when you want to talk about, can we do human reproduction in space? We don't even know if we can do rat reproduction. We don't even know like we could do like duck reproduction, right? And so obviously to have a permanent presence in space, that is like the sine qua non, is that you can make babies on site. And one thing that's quite ominous, you know, prima facie, from all that stuff I just described, you would worry. But we do have a kind of grab bag set of experiments on like all sorts, like lizards, geckos, frogs, fish, quail eggs, that show in many cases cell deformities, in one case like stillbirth, or gigantism in an offspring. Some are really weird. We had cases where, like, I can't remember what organisms, maybe lizards, where at one point they had unusually large heads, but then somehow it kind of reverted, so maybe it was okay. We've obviously never done this for like monkeys. In the case of rats, we've done like reproduction related experiments. But what you really want is mammals over generations. This often gets elided because you know, I think when people are in like a bar or something, they've had this like babies in space conversation to the extent that it goes on anywhere. But nerds are interested in this topic. So it does happen. Rarely do they talk about the part where you, now that you have the baby, it has to develop into a being that can also have children, right? And so that means like it has to endure all the stuff I just described. Maybe somewhat mitigated if you're on Mars, where a lot of the effects are due to microgravity, but you know, you're just going to have atmosphere issues, partial gravity, et cetera. We don't know. And so one thing I didn't mention about Mars, this is fairly recent stuff, that Mars' surface is about 0.5% to 1% perchlorates, thyroid hormone disrupting chemical.
So that really and everything from your evolution over and potentials for reproduction just as a population.
Just as a population, yeah.
Yeah. So if you're growing up there, what's that going to look like?
That is the deep question. And something that really frustrates us is you'll often get people who will say things like, we'll evolve because there's X constraint on us. Like Mars has a lot of radiation, so we'll get radiation proof, which is like, one, just sort of biologically absurd because you're not going to be walking around outside. You only get evolution if there's a differential survival rate for offspring, right? Right. So a much more likely case, for example, is if I were going to predict a type of evolution I would expect in space, it might be that there are some genotypes that, for example, under all the conditions described, experience a higher rate of spontaneous abortion. And so you'll get a gene shift. But it's not obvious that you're going to get something like, you know, some people will say, well, maybe we'll be tall on Mars because gravity is low. And it's like, this is like a just bizarre, like we have no idea if that's going to happen. Like it could be the opposite. There could be some like gravity deterministic process in gestation that does the exact opposite. We have no idea.
You're dealing with fluid dynamics of your body. And absolutely. You have that as a pressurized system. So
yep. No, totally. Yeah. So I think it's unpredictable. It really depends. Like, suppose we don't go to Mars for 200 years and sure. we're like cyborg super advanced people. And so nobody's like exposed to anything bad. Then why would you expect any change in gene frequency? Right. So it just really depends. I think people need to think more deeply about this. But I would say in terms of like day to day life, I mean, it really just depends on, you know, one thing we advocate for is kind of waiting until more people can go at once. Right. So one thing that really creeps us out about these scenarios is, suppose you say, well, we'll start with a population of 100. You know, the population of 100, if one person can't work, that's 1% of your labor force is out, right? Yeah. And so one thing we talk about, like, if you have all these conditions, you should expect a higher than normal rate of people dealing with, say, physical or cognitive handicaps. You know, people who need help. People on Earth, we have a really wonderful ecosystem, infrastructure to help these people. Many of us have complaints about it, but it's surely better than if you were living in a hostile environment, like it's the equivalent of a submarine. And you will often find space advocates. We have 3 quotes from different people from different parts of this universe who say essentially we should let evolution take its course, whatever precisely that means to you. So meaning, like, to my mind, essentially saying we should create an ethically monstrous society because Mars is cool. So that's why we advocate for going big, so at least then you can have division of labor to help these people. But so it's like this kind of ethical quagmire we're stepping into. And I like to think, you know, we've been accused of being too right-leaning and too left-leaning. To my mind, the idea of like conducting a like vast experiment on babies for no reason seems to be transcendent of politics. That just seems like an ethical no-no. And I would also say, like I said, we have quotes from people who are saying this out loud, who are saying, well, we'll change our ethical standards, or we'll change what counts as valuable human life. They're just saying it out loud.
At that point, it comes down to, is it science? Is it religion? Right. Is it like huge topics for us for evolution? Is it going to be an orphan black scenario where we...
That's what I think. I mean, like I said, it's like we wrap a lot of fantasies around space about a more sort of beautiful, awesome civilization. And we're saying from the beginning, you're going to be saying like people who can't pull their weight because of like defects they were born with because you put them here, it's okay to do away with them. Like that's like I hope obviously ethically monstrous. It's not a like you're a big wimp with your being anti my cool Davy Crockett frontier. It's like just obviously terrible. And so like if it can be avoided, it should. And that brings us full circle to you would ask what the sort of research impediments are.
Right.
Nothing is being spent on this comparatively. Like NASA has like small programs. Right. Generally speaking, historically, the agencies around the world have been very squeamish, not unreasonably, because nobody wants to go before Congress and be like, we're doing experiments in human sexy times in space, you know, but that's what you need to know.
Of course. Now, I'm just thinking about everything else that's like, big picture, what happens with everything from that to crops to
right? Yeah, so the thing to understand, most likely if you start a civilization, supply chains, yeah. So right, so you know, a human being eats a lot, not to mention we also like changes of underwear and clothing. So we require a lot. There are different estimates for how much a human being needs for, say, a year, but it's on the order of tens of tons, right? It's non-trivial.
Sure.
So, you know, you would like to be able to grow crops, right? So because growing crops, it's not just that it's a food source. It's also a way to clean up water. It's also a way to get materials. It's also a way to get oxygen out of carbon dioxide, which is especially cool on Mars. People often imagine you'll have a glass dome. You know, this is in some sense physically possible, and it would be kind of cool to get that solar power. The problem is you have basically zero pressure outside, so you can't just put up windows, right?
Windstorms, right?
Yeah, yes, and windstorms. I don't know. I haven't thought about that. So the windstorms do get up to 60 to 100 miles per hour, but remember the atmosphere is only 1%. So I actually don't know that would be the biggest challenge of you had like a big geodesic dome, especially considering how reinforced it would need to be for the glass to be there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I could be wrong. That's like not easy physics for me to do in my head. but someone out there can come in with a calculation. But yeah. So you would ideally like to build a sealed ecosystem that could close the loop. So it's called closed loop ecology. The closed loop meaning like people create waste. The waste becomes plant life. The plant life becomes food. The food becomes waste. The loop is closed. And so obviously this is basically what we have on Earth. Not counting the input of the sun, but of course on these other surfaces you'd want the sun's input too. We don't know a lot about how to do this. So there were a couple Soviet experiments called BIOS. We talk about them in the 60s. They were not close to closed loop. They put in a lot of food. they were not trying to do a solid waste. I don't believe in any of them. The biggest one amply is Biosphere 2, which I'm finding people under about 35 years old all remember Biosphere 2. It's getting to where it's becoming old news and people don't know and have to explain it. So in short, you have 3.14 acres in Arizona. It's a giant greenhouse, but it's basically sealed. That's not to say there's no gas exchange, but not on purpose. So they claim it was tighter than the space shuttle, which also leaks a little bit.
Yep.
And the idea was that they were going to live off the land. And they basically did this for 2 years. You know, there are some ways in which it wasn't completely closed. They got energy off the grid. Worth noting that they were basically starving by the end. At one point, they were running out of oxygen due to a glitch in the design of the system. So they had to have piped in oxygen. But they did basically do it. And it's worth noting that they did it despite a whole lot of stuff going wrong that would have been, I think, fairly trivial to fix in round two. But there never was a round two due to, like, financial mismanagement stuff. There was part of one. And so it's interesting. It's a good segue because, you know, we talked about the problem of pressure with building a dome. One thing that's not commonly known about Biosphere, one of the features they had was called lungs. So these giant tunnels on the system that routed to these huge chambers with nothing in them but these sort of giant flexible surfaces. And that was because if you have a greenhouse that's sealed, it tends to get hotter on the inside than outside. You get a pressure difference, yeah, and you're going to crack your windows. So they have to have these huge pressure management systems. So it's very, very complex. They had, like, you know, this is the 90s, but they actually had, like, underground server banks to monitor everything. It was really cool. I mean, there are a lot of jokes about it. Cool. Oh, go ahead.
Like, that is really cool. Like, you don't think about how much gas and pressure is built up in one of those greenhouses, right? So, like, you walk into, like, a nursery or something on Earth, and it's hot as sin.
Yes, and muggy.
But what's actually going on there? There's a lot of chemical interactions that we kind of have to pull also for potentially reserves if we need that heat.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, that's the thing. You want to use this as efficiently as possible. And so the problem is because that system, you know, didn't do it a second run, everything since then, there are ongoing experiments. They're quite small. They're like on the scale of like a small part of a warehouse. They have 2 to 3 people. Some don't even have people. You know, if you want to do this on Mars, we need like so much more science. But it's just like objectively cool. Like I'm like a botany gardening nerd, so maybe I'm a little more in the tank than other people. But it's just so awesome. Like you have this greenhouse that's sealed and people are living off the produce of the land. They're even having animals to help do stuff, which is, you know, kind of controversial in the design community for this stuff. But still, like, you know, this is a huge open area of science. Like, if I were Elon Musk and I were really serious about humans on Mars in 30 years en masse, I would buy Biosphere 2 yesterday and spin it back up and build, like, 3 or 4 copies. It's, compared to the cost of putting stuff in space, it's cheap. I think the current estimates are that, like, in modern dollars, it costs several $100 million to build the system and operate it. So, like, compare, you know, NASA's budget is $20 billion. If the goal was space settlement, this would be a good spend. But possibly with also a cool spin.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardy Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardy Alliance today.
For like ag stuff. But basically, almost like with reproduction, there is money being spent. It's quite trivial, even though it's like this crucial problem that will take many decades to solve.
Now, two things that I'm thinking about right now is, what about people and their mental health? How does that change?
Yeah, that's a cool question.
Like medical side of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you talked about that in the book a little bit.
So, and,
yeah.
So this is actually probably the hardest chapter for us to write. It was originally like 20,000 words, which is it was a real no. You can't do a fifth of your book on this one topic. So it's I think it's now like a fifth of that length. So the basic deal, though, the reason it took so long is that there isn't really a clear picture. So there was an article going around, I forget it was New York Times or somewhere, saying like the real impediment to space settlement is the psychiatric trauma. And I hate to be a kind of wet blanket on such a cool title, but like actually the severe impediment is probably exactly what you'd expect. It's getting oxygen to breathe and having a place to live. So I think maybe because of movies or books or something, humans have this idea that we go mad in confined environments. But nuclear submarines have operated since the 50s. They go down for 3 to 6 months. Rate of psychological incidents for the limited data available is actually lower than back home. Mind you, there's a lot of selection that goes on. There's also a lot of actions taken to mitigate distress, right? So they make sure there's good food, there's letters home, this and that. We're like, also humans have been going up for extended periods to space for very long periods. There is not one incidence of a severe psychiatric break. We found in the whole history of both space programs, both the big programs, there were 2 incidents when missions were called short due to maybe psychiatric stuff, both under extraordinary conditions. So in one case, just to give the example of the one time, which is pretty clear that a mission was called off early due to psychological stuff. What had happened is there were some Soviets in a space station. You have to imagine it's much smaller than an apartment room. You got 2 people and then the power goes off, right? There's no lights, the oxygen system, nothing is working, right? How did they survive? You might wonder, well, there's a lot of, the oxygen system, I think you can make it run without electricity. And also just there's a lot of residual oxygen. There's no ventilation though, so you have to move around so you don't get carbon dioxide poisoning. And they just existed like this, I think, for hours until they finally got the system on and it was decided to bring them home early, which doesn't seem weird to me. It doesn't seem like it was due to humans go mad every time they get confined together. So unfortunately, there's not a clear story that says we really need to be careful about this. The lessons we know, stretching back to the era of polar exploration, which had somewhat similar conditions, is like little bit important stuff, like people like to have the news, they like to have entertainments, they don't like to be bored, they like to have letters from home if they can have them, they like the food to be good and novel in texture and taste if they can. And so NASA does this. But that's the answer. There's no kind of like space madness problem, except the only big question mark is, I mentioned earlier, there's equivocal evidence of cognitive decline. It could be if people are in space for 5, 10, 20 years, there is something due to, say, the radiation or the microgravity or who knows what, and that'll have to be dealt with. The other issue, I think, really the more serious thing is like, I wouldn't want to have anyone walk away thinking, okay, the psychological stuff is overrated. I think some versions, the sort of fantastic versions of it are overrated. However, if you want to have 1,000 people on Mars who cannot easily get home, you have to assume at least a baseline rate of psychiatric distress, which means both you have to deal with chronic issues, meaning there has to be some psychological counseling for people who do experience depression, which has happened in space and has happened in Antarctica. But also, what do you do if someone, as has occasionally, very occasionally happened in like Antarctica, what do you do if someone pulls a knife on somebody? Or is it was clearly like experiencing an unforeseen like development of schizophrenia. What do you do? I mean, I worth noting that a lot of the drugs we have for this, the good stuff for it, are not designed to be shelf stable in space for 2, 4, 6 years. And what do you do? So like NASA has a protocol for the ISS, which essentially consists of tying someone up with bungee cards and doping them. But on the, which is already, it's never happened. And the protocol does include like, the hope that they will do this voluntarily, but you can, on the ISS, you can get home in under 24 hours in an emergency, right? We have escape pods.
Sure.
You can't do that on Mars. You might literally not even if you have the rocket, the launch window may not be open. So what do you do?
Of course, like you are dependent on whatever resources you have there.
Right.
And we will be dependent on, I'll say, Earth, or if Earth ends up migrating to some other space station, like the per se home planet, we're dependent on that.
Right. Yeah. So this is for us, this is another case where the answer is ideally a space settlement shouldn't be bootstrapped. It should be a large population at the outset so that there's more redundancy, more division of labor, more resources in terms of like keeping a pharmacology and just facilities for people who do have problems. So one finding that for us was very interesting about Antarctica, you might think people are more likely to go crazy in Antarctica. And indeed, people report struggles with that long overwinter when there's not much light. But the rate of like acute psychiatric incidents is different studies, but it's at least not higher. It's equal or lower. And again, some of that selection, it's not random people. But
that's the big thing. It's like it's selection.
Yeah, I think that's right. So for people who don't know, so one, there's self-selection. Like I personally would not want to go to Antarctica. So people who do want to go are not going to be psychologically normal or psychologically baseline, let's say. But also there is a questionnaire. right? There's a fairly involved questionnaire, and there's other stuff, right? So they similar to what they do for space, right? And also just worth noting, I think you're also just selecting the kind of people who have the wherewithal to get to a point where they're like a grad student in whatever that allows you to petition to go to Antarctica. This is not a random subset. Now, if they were having children, though, it is a kind of random draw. Right. Right. If they weren't having children, those children did not fill out a questionnaire. They did not say they wanted to be here. Right. So they're going to be more likely to be baseline. So I don't want to speak for anyone in particular, but there are very few parent offspring astronaut combinations. There are a few. They're probably more likely to be astronauts than random people, the kids of astronauts. But it's very rare. They tend to just be regular people like anyone. You know, there's a regression to the mean. They're not going to be these like bizarre, weird, ultra competent people like their parents were. And so you should just expect that in space. You should expect baseline rates of everything and plan for that. Yeah.
Just little topic shift.
Yes. So
we're looking at outer space treaties, right?
Yeah.
And what is technically a legal breach with these things? How do we go about space treaties?
Yes.
Just in general.
Yeah. So the first thing to know about space law is that it exists. Most people I find are surprised when you say space law. Of course, they also imagine it's like a guy in a spacesuit with a briefcase, and it's not. That either it's like property law for international regimes. Sure. Very similar to the law of like the international waters and Antarctica. It exists. The second thing to know is, unfortunately, we're stuck with this word law. And when people hear international law, they imagine it's like domestic law where there's like a police branch and like courts that everyone obeys. And there's not. And so
No, we actually do have it. Space Force.
Yeah, well, okay, yes. Yeah, well, I say this, if China is behaving badly, this is worth delineating, because people, I think, don't understand this. Like, if China does something bad that's quote-unquote illegal in space, right, the repercussion is not that someone like Space Force shows up and knocks on the door and says, you're under arrest, ladies and gentlemen. You know, that's not international law. International law refers to the set of treaties and established norms between countries and the way they interface with great powers. And that said, you know, so people tend to, when they hear that, they say, oh, so it's just made up. And it's like, well, the law of all nations is made up. The question is enforcement. So like, let me give the background real quick. I won't go into crazy detail because I worry people start getting bored. But essentially, the big governing document for space is the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, signed by all the major powers, including the major space powers. And essentially, for our purposes, as people interested in space settlement, the main things to know are, number one, Article 2 says no sovereignty in space. That means like no national claims. You might say, what does sovereignty mean? It essentially means Canada. It means there is some region that has a single government over it. It regulates what goes in and out and what the rules are internally. And importantly, that everyone else basically agrees to this. The new standard is Canada. Yeah. I mean, so I use Canada because there are these like edge cases. People will be like, well, what about like the Vatican or like the Knights Templar? And you're like, oh, they're weird edge cases, but essentially, you know what I mean. Nation states, you know, so like, you can't do that in space, period. It's utterly unambiguous. People try to come up with loopholes like, well, what if McDonald's claimed to check with space? No, McDonald's would be made up of people from Earth states, so it would be a claim. You can't do it. Like anything you can think of as a loophole some lawyer thought of 60 years ago, no. No national claims. You can't have a U.S. state. You can't have a new nation that doesn't recognize the treaty. None of this is allowed under international law. You can, of course, violate international law, but it should be recognized as such. Yeah. The other thing to know, other than that you can't have a nation or sovereignty, is that you can claim resources ad libitum. So it's a, you know, the most absurd example we could think of is, well, there are a couple, but like one of my favorites is you could, you know, we said earlier the water is very limited. You could say you were Jeff Bezos, you could land a rocket on the moon, collect all the water for yourself, turn it into an ice sculpture of yourself, and explode it. And there's not obviously anything illegal under space law about that. Would you anger many people and nations? Yes. But you would probably have not violated the law, especially under the current understanding that the U.S. is pushing in, which many nations are signing on to, which is quite libertarian. So, you know, you might say to yourself, well, this is perverse. You have a regime where I could, like, grind up an asteroid into my own spaceship and claim it as mine, but I could not put a flag on that asteroid before I did it. It's kind of bizarre. And arguably sort of conflict prone, because it does allow for like sort of quasi territory claims. Like you could set up a strip mining operation on half the moon, but it's not your territory. It's weird. And the deal is essentially there was an attempt in the late 70s to clarify the regime. It was called the Moon Agreement. You can look it up. That would have clarified the property regime, essentially making some sort of international body to regulate claims. It probably would have been quite restrictive. And the short version is none of the space powers signed on to it. The U.S. thought it actually wanted to ratify it. Our diplomats wanted to ratify it. The Congress thought it was too socialist-y. But the Soviets, the officially socialist Soviet Union, also said no. And I think the parsimonious guess is that why would you give up access to all these resources as a space power? Why would you give that up to like France or Italy or Australia when you could keep it for yourself if it's going to be useful? So the agreement was technically ratified because enough nations signed it, but none of the space powers did. It's largely considered to not be important. And no major space law has been signed since, other than, you know, there have been resolutions and things. And so that's where we are right now. And it's kind of not been an issue because, you know, after the crazy 60s, everyone thought space was going to be a big deal soon. And it turned out not to be. And it's changing now because SpaceX made the price so low, where we're getting to a world where there's much more space activity. To give you a cool stat to embody that, you know, prior to SpaceX launching satellites, Starlink satellites, there had ever been something like 9,000 satellites ever launched. Starlink itself, SpaceX's ISP company, controls something like over 3,000 now. So there's been a real change. I mean, it's a little apples to oranges because size, you know, they're small satellites, blah, blah, blah. But things have genuinely changed. And so our worry is that you get some kind of scramble over the good spots on the moon. Like I said, I don't think they're economically viable, but space is very national security, saber-rattly stuff. It always has been. Okay. And so you worry you get, you know, like well, imagine how you feel, say, if you're a Western-aligned person, if you wake up one morning and China says, we just put 100 people in a base on the most valuable parts of the moon, and we're not formally claiming sovereignty, but all the water here is ours, right? Obviously, that's a crisis.
And I don't know.
Yeah, how about now? Yeah. I mean, that's why we're in favor of a boring international regime.
Right. So out of curiosity, for us traveling there, like, what are the big takeaways that you would want people to know?
Yeah, okay, big takeaways. One, there is a kind of route forward to space settlement, and we give a kind of roadmap, which is we need to solve, obviously we need to solve the tech stuff, but that's kind of on a good trajectory. We need to solve reproduction, medical stuff, and ecology, and then we also really need a better legal regime that doesn't permit a kind of free-for-all that could exacerbate international tension and endanger the home planet. And so in terms of the takeaways and knowledge, so that's the roadmap. I would just want to say, if you haven't read our book, or a couple other books I could recommend, like Erica Nesvold's Off Earth or maybe Daniel Dudney's Dark Skies, you will be frequently exposed to articles in the news or in headlines that are basically simply wrong. Elide major issues having to do with what is physically likely or you're allowed to do, such as the claim that we're in some sort of Cold War moon race with the moon. And like, you know, it's bad enough as nerds, we're all nerds here, it's bad enough to be misinformed. But to be misinformed by agency heads and leaders of countries who stand to benefit from your fear of other countries is not just to be misinformed, it's dangerous. We are not going to be in a mining war with China because there is nothing worth mining. Don't believe the articles. So my pitch to people is please read our book, if for no other reason than to avoid this kind of insane posturing stuff that you might be misled into.
Okay. And anything that you have for like big projects that are coming up? Otherwise, outside of the book,
you mean for me or for like space agencies?
For you, space, for whatever.
I worry I'm going to disappoint people. Yeah. So my actual next, what I'm fretting about currently is I write children's books. I'm actually my other foot is in poetry for children. So I'm working on. I wrote an adaptation of Beowulf for children called Beowulf, which is about a sort of girl who fights old people, and. It was fairly popular with the right crowd anyway, but I'm sort of fine to finish the story and it's agonizing. And then Kelly has some cool pop science ideas. She might do one on her own. She's got some cool stuff. She's a parasitologist. Some of her work is too icky for me. And so there's that. But honestly, this book was such murder to research. We're still kind of catching our breath a year later.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Some of those are just very large undertakings.
Yes, endless.
So I just thank you for coming on the show today and getting to talk with me.
Yes.
I can assure you that the audience is going to be really jazzed about this.
I'm always glad when people ask about the law stuff, because I can talk about space poop all day, but the law is more interesting.
Okay, mathematicians go right alongside philosophers. So this is...
There it is, there it is.
The legal stuff is heavy into philosophy.
It is.
You love that. So thank you, Zach, for your time and for joining us on Breaking Math.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Well, that was a wild ride through Martian society and the potential pitfalls of living on a new planet. But fear not, math enthusiasts. There's more brain and math goodness where that came from. If you're still feeling the after effects of our journey through space travel, we will have more math next week. So here's how to stay connected. We're on all major podcast platforms. Just search for Breaking Math. Follow us on social media at Breaking Math Pod on Twitter or your favorite mathematical figure, X. And at Breaking Math Media on Instagram and Reels for exclusive content, terrible jokes, and the occasional thread where we'll be doing a lot more math and maybe some cute and nerdy surprise content that we've been cooking up behind the scenes. So until next time, I'm Autumn FNF, your host on Breaking Math Podcast.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing, another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.